Hey folks, sorry for the long radio silence with the podcast. Been sitting on this episode actually for a while. I had it all posted and ready to go at the end of March, but when Taylor passed away, it just didn't seem like the right time to put it out. So I shelved it and been meaning to get back to it ever since, but it just took a minute. So my apologies. I was thinking about re-recording the intro because I had recorded it like the preamble to the interview when we were in Bogota. And obviously before everything went south, but I don't know, listening to it today, it kind of put a smile on my face because it was like a happy time and things seemed like they were on the up and up for the year. So I'm just going to leave it as is and, you know, hope you dig it. I don't know when I'm going to get back to doing fresh episodes, probably not for a while. Things are kind of busy right now, but, maybe at some point. Anyway, here you go. Walking the floor. Check it out.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to episode number 212 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Never has that opening line been so appropriate as it is this week, because I'm sitting here in my hotel room in beautiful Bogota, Colombia, down here with Foo Fighters doing shows. We played Mexico City, we played Santiago, Chile, we played Buenos Aires, Argentina. We went to Asunción, Paraguay. We were supposed to play, but sadly that show got rained out by a gnarly thunder and lightning storm that swept the whole town down the street and flooding, and it was just nuts. We were sitting there at the hotel getting updates, and I was getting texts from my guitar tech Sean of just like crazy scenes going on. So they evacuated the festival site and the whole thing got canned, which was a bummer because we were there and we were ready to go, and I hate the way that feels. I just hate any time we cancel a show. It's just the worst feeling. It feels like defeat. But yeah, you can't beat the weather. I've come to learn over the years. So there you go. Anyway, so we're playing tonight in Bogota, and then we go to Sao Paulo, Brazil, and then we will go home and continue our crazy year of lots and lots and lots of touring, which is fantastic. It's good to be back at it. Anyhow, let's talk about our good friends at Zounds.com. Did you know that Zounds has an easy payment plan to make your gear affordable? That way you get the gear you want today and pay for it over a period of months. And they offer you flexible payment plans over the course of like 4, 6, 8, 12 months, whatever you need. Whatever you need to get the gear you want from Zounds.com, the greatest online music retailer in the entire world. All right, let's get to today's interview. It's a good one. All right, this week I'm talking to none other than Haley Witters, Iowa born and bred by way of Nashville. She seemingly burst onto the scene a couple years ago with her tune, Janice at the Hotel Bar. But of course, she's been around a lot longer than that, writing songs and making records. And she just put out a fantastic brand new record a couple weeks ago called Raised. Go stream it wherever you stream your music or buy it or whatever. She was a real blast to talk to. She just struck me as like an artist firing on all cylinders, totally in command of her superpowers. And we had a great little chat. So check it out. This is Haley Witters on Walking the Floor.
And everything she ain't.
Got it. What's going on? There's so many little buttons that you've got to hit just to get into the room.
I know. Now, Haley, I have to ask you, do you know that your Zoom handle is Corn Queen?
Okay, so I do. I had to do a thing with the Opry a while back where I wasn't allowed, like they wanted me to change my name. They didn't want people to know it was Haley yet. And so we changed it to Corn Queen on a whim. And I haven't really changed it back. It's kind of just funny to me at this point. I should probably change it, but it's just kind of funny. Nobody knows what they're going to get when they see the Corn Queen.
I liked it. I thought it was good. It cracked me up when I saw that.
Yeah. How are you? Where are you calling from?
I'm in subarctic Los Angeles, California this morning.
Very cool.
Where it's downright freezing here, 61 degrees.
Oh my God.
And I will warn you, I'm also suffering from jet lag because we just got back from Australia a couple days ago. So I had to pry myself out of bed this morning, but I'm hoping that the cold kind of props me up and gets me through it.
Yeah, that's awesome. How was Australia?
Australia was great. Yeah, we had a great time. Yeah.
Good.
Played a really good show and got some beach time in, and you know, it was like that's what you want.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm leaving for the UK tomorrow, and it's kind of like my first, you know, post COVID, like, or I guess COVID, like leaving and dealing with all the, you know, passports and vax cards and all that stuff. So yeah.
Yes, that was, it was same with us. And this was like, that was like one of our first international trips, you know, since COVID. Yeah. It's nice to see the international stuff is starting to come back, you know, to make like a real tour schedule. Like, do you tour much outside of the States?
This is my first time.
First time ever, really?
First time ever.
Oh,
first time ever. I mean, I guess I played Canada, like, it's been a few years. Yeah. That was like on a bus thing where you get out at border and whatnot. But like, this is the first time really going over. Yeah, I've been waiting to do this for a long time. I guess these shows actually have been booked since 2019. So,
oh really?
We're finally going.
Wow. Yeah, the UK loves country music.
That's what I've heard, and I'm very, you know, I have a lot of friends that tour over there, and they're like, dude, they're gonna love you over there. You got to get over there. And I've just, it's never, you know, it's never worked out. So I'm very excited to get to go finally.
Is it, are you doing like headline shows or a festival or is it a package tour? What sort of thing? Festival. Okay,
yeah. It's cool. Like a big country festival. So it's called Country to Country, I think. And we're doing like London and Ireland and Scotland.
So fun.
Yeah. I'm stoked.
Well, if you need any tourist tips, I'll be happy to point you in the right direction.
Send your like food recs. Apparently London's supposed to have really good Indian food.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, the food's great over there. Food in Ireland actually kind of blew my mind the first time I ever kind of traveled over there.
Really?
Was good everywhere. But I'll tell you, you should go catch an Arsenal game while you're in London if you have
an Arsenal game.
Yeah, that's the team that I support. And it's like unlike anything you've ever experienced. It's just a different kind of sports environment. It's going to a football game over there is like is similar, I think, to like a gig, because the whole crowd's singing and there's like the away supporters and the home supporters and they're jostling each other. It's just it's a wild environment. It's fun.
Wow, very cool. Yeah. I'm not much of a sports person, but I'll have to check that out.
Well, if you're not much of a sports person, then we're claiming you as an Arsenal fan. You don't have a say in the matter. Hey, let's jump into this. You know, from the outside looking into your music life, it looks like you're in like this great place. You know, you've got success. People love your music. You've got this hotly anticipated new record. You've got, you know, touring, sold out tours, all that sort of thing. Lori McKenna posting nice things about you on Instagram. I mean, what could be better? I guess the question I have, like, are you managing to, as things are taking off for you, are you managing to stop and smell the roses along the way?
Well, I'm also in the midst of planning a wedding, so no. No, I know I'm in this weird spot where I'm like trying to balance both professional and personal right now, but I guess that's kind of how it always should be, right? But yeah, I mean, I definitely try to. Like I am so excited about what I've been creating right now, what is about to come out. My head is just so in touring record mode, thinking about, you know, more songs to be writing and all of that stuff. And it can get very hard sometimes to remember, like, to turn it off and to go hike or go do something else. But that is an important part of my creative process for me. Like, I kind of have to like tap out to tap in. You know, especially when I'm in songwriting mode, I get a lot of inspiration from going back home and people watching and, you know, going to, you know, your cousin's potluck dinner or something like that. Hear who's getting married, who's getting divorced, who's, you know, who's died, all of that stuff to go really just integrate into real life, as I call it. But things are so busy right now. I'm touring a lot. So I actually just had my first weekend home in several weeks. And I feel like I just day drank all day Saturday. I had a really great weekend. I did a lot. I was really busy and I was kind of looking at photos of the weekend recap and I was like, gosh, I really drank a lot of beer this weekend.
Well, you're just doing research for songwriting. I mean, totally. you mentioned
right?
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned going home to kind of recharge your batteries and sort of plug back into regular life a little bit. Like, as a songwriter, do you kind of always have your songwriting antenna up, like soaking up, like, oh, my cousin said some little turn of phrase, or my mom said this, or are you always kind of jotting that stuff down and then taking that into writing?
Yeah, totally. I mean, if, you know, you have to be careful around me because whatever you say might get turned into a song somewhere. So I keep my phone on me at all times, as we all do these days. But I'm constantly, if something sparks, I'm jotting it down and saving that for later, for sure.
I mean, did you start out in on the business side of things as a songwriter? Like, did you move to Nashville as a Music Row songwriter? Because I see you write a lot. And write for other people and stuff. Was that sort of how you began? Were you doing that before you were, you know, got a record deal and all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I moved to town just wanting to be an artist. And when I came to town, it was made known to me that in order to be an artist, you had to write your own songs. So I just started co-writing and songwriting all the time as a way to try and get a deal as an artist. I just felt like it was very important to figure out what I wanted to say first. And I did that through songwriting.
Had you done a lot of writing before you moved to Nashville?
By myself. I mean, you know, like, I grew up in small town Iowa. There wasn't a whole lot of community for me there with songwriting or playing shows, even any of that. So I was like a bedroom songwriter. You know, I just sat in my room, got a guitar, learned a few chords. I wrote the lyrics to my songs like on my bedroom wall, which my parents were not pleased about. I wrote a lot by myself. So when I moved to town, actually, this is a really crazy story. My first co-write I ever had was with Casey Musgraves.
Really?
I was a fan of her at the time. She was on Nashville Star and I was a really big fan of her. And she had messaged me. I'd seen her down in Texas like a weekend or two before, and she had messaged me and was like, hey, I'm coming to Nashville. I would love to write with you sometime. I've been listening to your EP, which was terrible, by the way. I would love to write with you. And I was like so nervous because I'd never written with another person before. I felt very naked, very vulnerable, but I was like, I can't turn down Casey Musgraves. You know, I was such a fan. And so I said, yeah, sure, let's do it. And she came over and it was very hard. You know, I just felt like such a loser. I didn't say much. I was so nervous because not only is it my first co-write, but it's with someone that I've already like kind of just a fan of. And
sure.
It's very intimidating, very scary. So, you know, I walked away from that just like, you know, a little, you know, shook up, kind of like nervous and jittery and all that. But
did that song ever see the light of day? Whatever you guys
know, definitely not. I mean, this was like, she hadn't moved to town. I knew she was like a big deal down in Texas and stuff. But yeah, that was the very first song I ever wrote. So, and then after that, I started writing a lot more. I'd go to writer's nights in town and I would just listen to people play. And then I'd go up if I liked their songs and be like, hey, I'm Haley. I'd love to write sometime. And little by little, I just started meeting more people and expanding my network or whatever. And I was waiting tables. I was a nanny. I was trying to just pay the bills. And then I would go write book shows. Eventually I ended up funding an EP. And that got a lot of industry attention, and that kind of led to my first publishing deal. And then I had a publisher at that point who was booking me, and I just try and write all the time. I mean, I consider it like a full-time job. I write Monday through Friday, you know, do a session every time. I just considered it just me kind of honing in, trying to get better, just trying to write as much as possible.
I mean, when you're writing that much, how do you Like, I always find, and yeah, I've never been a music or a songwriter, but I've written with friends and stuff in Nashville, and, you know, with one or two other people or whatever, that sort of thing. And I always, for my own stuff, feel like it always works best when I have two or three ideas going into the room, you know, and then usually they have, whoever you're writing with has some ideas and you settle on something and it kind of works out. But like, when you're writing that much, how do you always, you know, kind of go to the well and have, how do you do that?
I had my first publisher was really great about kind of like telling me to stop writing, you know, or like go take a month off and go, don't pick up a guitar at all, you know? And that's really important to me because when you are kind of in the grind, you're just on the hamster wheel, it gets really stale. I do think there's a certain element of just like, I can find, so I like to go peace out, disappear for a while, restock, fill the well, get a bunch of ideas. And then I like to come back and like really hit it, because when I am writing consistently, I find, it's just kind of greased, you know, and it works a little easier sometimes. But yeah, I think, you know, there was an element too, like pretty early on where I was being really precious about things, and that can be just as stifling, you know? So sometimes just staying in a rhythm, you know, kind of helps me.
So it's interesting what you said a minute ago, is sort of like contrary to what I feel like I'd always sort of heard or imagined, sort of the Nashville system. You said that you know, when you first moved to Nashville, that it was clear to you that you had to be a writer to be a solo artist. I thought they always kind of kept tried to keep those worlds separate a little bit. You know, obviously lots of songwriters have gone on to have, you know, big solo careers and all that sort of thing. But I thought generally speaking, they sort of want to keep the writers over here and the artists over here and, you know, that sort of thing. Was that, I guess I was incorrect.
Well, and I don't know. I mean, I guess like both worlds kind of exist here a little bit. I think that that's probably just what people were kind of telling me. Right. Now, whether or not that was like, go like solidify who you are, figure out what you want to say, do that first. Maybe that's just kind of what they were telling me, which I think in the long run ended up probably being good advice, because I had to do kind of the self-discovery process, where sometimes you'll find a lot of artists who really don't know what they want to say, you know,
right.
And they still get a record deal and they can still go on, but like, they don't really know, you know, what songs they want to put on their record or not. And they'll have people on their team kind of telling them or feeding them what they should say and what they should sing and stuff like that. And I think it gave me a strong sense of kind of self, of like who I was, what I wanted to say, what I wanted to do, to just feel kind of grounded in that. You know, I don't have to write everything. In fact, I would love to put out a record sometime that is outside songs, because there are so many great, great songwriters in this town, always have been. The songwriting community is massively hurting right now, just with the royalty rates on streaming services and all of that. And it's making me really sad to see a lot of friends losing their jobs, because it's just there's no money in it. And so they can't sustain themselves. They can't sustain their families off songwriting. And it's a very sad thing, because there's some really great, I'd say like the album cut songwriters are disappearing. And I moved to town probably on album cuts. You know what I mean? Just like, or when I got here, those became the songs that just gave me chills, that stopped me dead in my tracks, that you hear at the Bluebird Cafe and you're just like, wow. You know what I mean? And so I always just, my motto is just best song wins, you know, whatever the best song is, whether I wrote it or there's eight writers on it or whatever, if it's a great song, I think it should be heard. And so I kind of got, you know, very immersed in like the songwriting community early on, just studying it and trying to write songs that you could feel really damn good about when you're sitting around with some of your heroes and the whole room's hanging on to listen to what you have to say, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You don't often, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody talk about that. when it comes to streaming royalty rates, you know, how much that's hurting the songwriting world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I mean, that's, you know, that's not good for art, I don't think, generally.
No, it's a really dark time for songwriters right now. And it really does make me sad, because I worry, without the people who are showing up to write something, you know, you show up in a songwriting session and I feel like sometimes it's like, let's just write something great today. And then some days it's like, let's write something that's going to make some money today. And I'm just worried that if people just start showing up for the latter, I don't know. I'm just like, what will the songs be like in 10 years?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you normally when you hear people talk about royalty rates, it's sort of in the context like, oh, rich rock stars complaining that they're not making enough money and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, you know, working class songwriters.
Yeah.
And artists, you know, of course, as well, you know, are the ones that are kind of hardest hit by that. It's sort of like, you know, you're seeing that sort of killing off people's, the sort of smaller artists' ability, smaller songwriters' ability to make a living, you know, it's a struggle.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, we just got really dark. since we're talking about writing, you know, at what point do you know you're going to earmark something that you've written for yourself, as opposed to it being pitched to somebody else? Do you know, like, even when it's just sort of the germ of the idea, maybe it's just a hook line or even just a feeling, a thought, a theme?
I think, like, if I can feel really connected to the lyric in some way, you know, if it feels just really true to me, where I came from, what's inspiring me, you know, sometimes it's just like a gut instinct. Sometimes it'll be a line in a session and I'm like, that line's so damn good, I'm putting that on my record. Save that one for me. I want to be the one to say that, you know? Sometimes it's like, you know, my producer hears like everything I hear, you know, and he has like a really good pulse, I think, on just who I am creatively, artistically, where I want to go. And so, I mean, sometimes I'll write songs that I'll turn in and I'm like, all right, I don't know, this probably is not for me, you know, and I'll kind of hear him explain to me why it might be, in a way, you know? And I've learned to trust the people around me a lot more, because I think, you know, I think that there's a lot of value in that. And I think that I've just been surprised, honestly. Some of the things that I remember, you know, when we were making the Dream record, there was a song that came in as a work tape. And I was just like, I don't really like that song. You know, I don't really like it. I don't really want to record it. I don't want to put it on the record. But I just went with it and trusted the people around me. And it ended up being one of my favorite songs to perform. Just seeing the connection between, you know, the fans, and it's become very sentimental to me over the years. So I try and really just trust the process, trust the people around me, before automatically just closing the door on something.
And is it the same team of people that worked on your latest record as the last one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The creatives. Yeah, definitely. Same producer. Jake Gear produced this record. Logan Matheny is the engineer. He was the engineer on the last. A lot of the musicians are the same, actually, too. Yeah.
That's sort of the beauty of having a good relationship with the producers, you know, being able to trust when they hear something that you don't, you know?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So let's talk about this record a little bit. Like, you know, I had read that in the bio that your publicist sent me, that it's sort of thematically about sort of reconnecting with your, you know, Midwestern roots or your hometown roots. As somebody who, you know, is a working musician, travels all the time, I'm sure, like, is that something, that feeling of connectedness, is that like something that is on your mind a lot, like something you struggle with, or is you know, because we're all kind of troubadours out here.
With the connectedness to like where I came from, like my hometown and stuff.
Or even just a connectedness to anywhere, you know?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it's like really funny because when I was young, you know, when I was a teenager dreaming about Nashville, I just like could not leave my hometown quick enough. It was like, I have got to get out of here. You know what I mean? I'm going to Nashville and I'm going to be a country music star and all these things. But even then, I had a plan to get back. You know, I told myself by the time I was 25, I mean, this just goes to show how stupid I was. I thought within 7 years of moving here, I would have been successful enough that I could afford to like move back home and build my life there and like, you know, raise my kids there or something and still be around my family. I mean, I come from a massive family. My mom and dad are both 1 of 9. My grandpa's 1 of 15. I'm 1 of 6. So I grew up with this very big, very fun, magnetic, a lot of energy, a lot going on all the time, this really big family. And I think despite wanting to get the heck out, I also knew that I was going to be giving up something very special. I was going to be giving up a lot of time away from them. So there was always this plan to try and get back. And I moved to town and I was very focused, very driven, very motivated by making records and touring and all of that stuff that I really didn't think much about moving back. And then it was kind of around year 10, you know, that I wasn't where I wanted to be. I was waiting tables again, trying to pay my bills. I'd had some success as a songwriter, but as we kind of said earlier, album cut songwriters don't make enough money to be able to live and, you know, and provide for themselves. So I was back working a part-time job. And so I was seeing a lot of my friends back home buying their houses, getting married, having baby 2, having baby 3, buying the boat, buying, you know, just being able to, you know, create their life, begin their lives together, you know? And I was starting to think, man, like I'm still waiting tables. Like I'm not where I want to be. Maybe I should start reconsidering a different career path. And in that I started kind of just feeling very nostalgic, very homesick for Iowa and being able to kind of, you know, look back on the quality of life, the pace of life, the, family element for me and really just starting to want that back. And so I think that that's kind of when, you know, on my record, The Dream, I have a song called Heartland. That's kind of about that, about, you know, kind of returning home. And that's when I think a lot of these songs for this record started being born. I was in that mindset. I was thinking a lot about home and, probably romanticizing it a little bit, you know, because I'm not there anymore. I'm not there every day.
You've been gone just long enough.
I've been gone just long enough to look back in kind of a romantic light and just kind of fantasize about that world and what that life might look like and all that. So that's kind of the headspace I was in when I was writing a lot of this record. It was looking back in my memories, remembering the things that, you know, that I grew up with and remembering how I grew up and writing about that.
Yeah. What is it about hometowns that it's like such a, they're so alluring for songwriting and, you know, it's just this constant grist for the mill. I was thinking about that the other day, like, it's like, fuck, I got to stop writing songs about where I grew up. It's like,
are
too
you
many
writing
of them.
It? I know, well, there's like, I don't know who said it, but it's always like that thing of like, wanting to make your hometown proud of you kind of thing. You know,
right,
I think we're
right.
Like always just kind of trying to make our hometown proud a little bit, you know, to be able to go home and like, anyways, I feel that way, but I don't know. I don't know why we do that as creatives. Like there's so much inspiration to pull from there, you know?
There is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like I said, I find myself pulling from that almost like all the time. And one, even songs that aren't exactly about it, I'm still kind of drawn from that period of my life, you know, the sort of like teenage years into like early adulthood. Yeah. It's just sort of this never ending supply. I mean, how you mentioned your last record, and I know that's when things really took off for you commercially. Like how has your life changed sort of professionally since then? I imagine you can get in the room with, oh, it sounds like you were able to get in the room with just about anybody you wanted before that, but I imagine now it's even more, you know?
Well, I mean, You know, I definitely could quit waiting tables. That was a huge plus. I got to go. I've been on the road for like, well, you know, obviously the pandemic, but I've been on the road constantly now, which has been really great. Able to make records and make records that I love, which is also a bonus. But I feel like, I don't know, that record just really got a lot of the town to finally kind of start taking me seriously, you know? And so I've been able to kind of just, I don't know. I feel like I've just been able to really afford to be able to make music that I love and to be able to play and tour and to commit to it full time.
How did BJ Barham from American Aquarium wind up on your record? I would think of you too as sort of inhabiting different parts of country music, or, you know, I think of him more as like Americana, but you know, it's all under the umbrella.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like such an Americana fan. I honestly listen to a lot of Americana music. I got one of my favorite tours that I've done so far. I toured with Brent Cobb, who you would say kind of occupies the Americana space. But to me, he's just one of the best country singer-songwriters that we have. I mean, I just think he's country to the bone.
Sure.
So the Americana thing's always kind of funny to me, because I just feel like it's kind of just country, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or the country that I grew up on anyways. But, you know, I don't know how this came about, but I've been writing a lot with BJ. And actually, Lori McKenna texted me and said, hey, I was writing with BJ Barham the other day. He brought up your name. Would you want to co-write with us sometime, or like jump in on a write? And I was like, heck yeah, I love American Aquarium. I mean, I'm especially like, they had just putting out the Bangers, Twangers, whatever that side project that they did where they were covering old country songs and whatnot. And I love that project. I think they did such a great job. And so I just jumped on that co-write, and, you know, we wrote once, got another day on the books, wrote twice. I think we've probably written maybe three times now, but we'd cut Middle of America, and it was just my vocal on it. And it felt really lackluster to me. I was like, something's missing here. And, you know, we need something here to really make this song kind of stand out. And my producer was like, well, what about BJ? You know, what about American Aquarium? It feels very Heartland Rock to me, you know, kind of the melancholy thing that I kind of grew up on. So it just seemed like a really natural fit. And we asked him, and he was like, heck yeah, I'll do it. So hearing him on it now, that was the missing piece. That's what it needed. It totally just took it to the next level, energy wise, everything. He sounds so good on it. And so I'm really glad that he's on that.
Well, you know, this record is a nice long record too. And in this era of short attention spans, it's got like intros and outros and interludes and skits, and, you know, it's got all this stuff, as well as like, what, like 13 full songs or something, you know, somewhere around there. I thought that was interesting, you know, like I said, considering this is people have a very short attention span these days. So what was sort of motivated you to do that? And did your label try to talk you out of it?
Surprisingly, the label didn't. I think like this has been just like such a living, breathing concept for a few years now. I mean, I have a whole bunch more songs that I'm ready to put on like another record. You know what I mean? It was kind of hard to like whittle it down, honestly. And I know it's just, even still, it's a giant amount of songs, but you know, I think that there were some songs that we really felt strongly about as just kind of being like the pinnacle things that people had to hear on this concept. And then it was kind of fleshing out some of the spaces to make it like a cohesive kind of thing. The record starts off on the prelude, and that was like a totally, we're in the middle of quarantine, my producers and composing this little piece. And I remember hearing it for the first time, and it felt very familiar, very nostalgic. Something about it felt familiar to me. And so, you know, he had said, what if we made this like the opening scene of your record. You know, the record feels like we're just kind of transporting people to a place, you know? And so I think having that as kind of just like, you know, the opening credit almost of a movie or something.
Right. Felt like cinematic.
Yeah. It felt very cinematic. And so that kind of came about, and then obviously having the record kind of hint at that, I think it just perfectly wraps it up. And then the interlude, like for Boys Back Home, that just happened in the studio. That was just like, you know, we were getting ready to lay down Boys Back Home, and Mike Rojas, and who's on keys, and Pat McGrath, who was on guitar, they just started like riffing off each other in the studio. And I was like, someone hit record. This feels incredible to me. It's nearly brought me to tears. It just felt so emotional, anthemic. And now they did try and talk me into cutting that off. You know, I can't remember if it was the label or the producer, but they're like, hey, this is a little long winded. Should we cut it? And I was like, no, I will fight you till the end, because you know, I just want people to hear that. It just felt really emotional and beautiful. And so that's on there. And then the skit about, that's actually my Aunt Cindy on The Grassman. That's my Aunt Cindy and my friend Aaron Ratier. And my Aunt Cindy used to answer the phones for my grandpa.
Oh, that's Aaron on there?
Yeah. You know Aaron?
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know. I was just texting with him a couple days ago. Yeah, I love Aaron.
What other stoner would you think to put on that song? When you need a stoner, you think Aaron Ratier. You know what I mean? But so that was like, you know, my grandpa on Our Grass Is Legal, my grandpa had a sod farm growing, like when I was growing up in the 70s, 80s, and my dad and all his brothers worked for him out in the fields and all that. He grew grass. And so he called himself the Grass Man, and then people started looking for pot. So that's kind of what that song's about. He made his business motto, Witter's Turf Farms, Our Grass Is Legal. I have his hat upstairs, and it has like dirt stains and all that, but it says that. And, you know, my aunt used to answer the phones. And so that's kind of like what the calls she would get sometimes. So we wanted to just like reenact that, kind of just a funny thing to set up the song a little bit, I guess, for folks who don't really know the story.
I think you guys should reinvent the company now that like grass is legal in most places.
Right? Oh, don't tell my little brother that. He would love to just start a pot farm. I don't think it's legal in Iowa yet.
Okay.
I'm sure it's on its way.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. You know, since we're talking a lot about songwriting here, I'm curious how that Beautiful Noise song that Alicia Keys and Brandi Carlile did, like, how did that come about?
Well, so my friend Brandi Clark had texted me one day and said, hey, I got asked about writing a song for the 100th. It was like 100th women's anniversary, right to vote or something. And she hit me up and was like, hey, would you want to write a song for this? And I'm thinking about asking Hillary and Lori. And I was like, say no more. I am there.
There's a bunch of great writers credited on that track. I mean, were you guys all sitting in a room together throwing ideas around, or were you passing a tape? Like, how did that happen?
Well, and that was like in the thick of the pandemic. So it had started with just the four of us. And we knew, like, going into it, Brandi was like, okay, this is going to be a collaborative thing. So maybe we just write a verse chorus, start kind of getting some bones together, and then it's going to go on to grow. So we knew that. But originally, we all sat down and Zoomed, you know, it was like the thick of the pandemic. So the four of us are just on a Zoom. And I think we wrote like a verse chorus. And then Brandi was like, cool, I'm going to, you know, pass this around, see who else wants to jump on. And I think she'd been the one to get it to Brandi Carlile. I don't know for sure about that. But Brandi Carlile ends up getting involved and bringing in Linda and Ruby and Alicia. And to this day, I've never met them. I mean, I've met Brandi Carlile now via Zoom, but I've never met her in person, and I've not yet met the other girls at all. So it's been this really cool collaborative moment, you know, that's just kind of brought us all together on this song. And so I'm hoping that, you know, maybe we can hopefully meet each other finally at the Grammys, because I would love to get to just meet those women.
Yeah. I mean, was like, what did you think when you was the first time that you heard the final version of it, like the version that they cut?
Actually, it might have been. I think it was the first time. It was the first time. I remember sitting on, I mean, we'd had like a demo or something, but I think at that point it only had Brandi Carlile on it. So yeah, we're like sitting on the couch watching, I think it was CBS that they were performing it on, her and Alicia, and they were like, you know, facing each other on piano or something. And that was the first time I'd ever heard it. And that was a trip to hear Alicia Keys singing a song. I mean, and Brandi Carlile, I'm a huge Brandi. So to get to hear them both like singing on a song that you, you know, had a part, a very small part in, was a really cool feeling.
So cool. So, I mean, so you're going to be out at the Grammys?
Yes.
Nice. Nice.
Are and you going out there?
We are going to be out there. Yeah. I believe we are. I don't know if it's public knowledge, but I think we're playing that night.
Very
actually,
cool.
It must be. They didn't tell me to keep it a secret, so I'm assuming that the world knows. So, or at least hopefully they will. But hopefully the world knows by the time I post this interview. You know what I mean?
Well, then maybe I'll get to meet you in person there too.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'll look for you for sure. So your record Raised, it comes out on March 18th. And what's next? Touring, festivals, headliner shows, support slots, just, you know, the worldwide takeover.
World domination.
Yes.
No, we're leaving for the UK tomorrow. We're going to go to Europe, play. I'm finishing out my headlining tour in the spring, my first headlining tour. And then I'm going to go on the road with John Party this summer.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
West Coast country. Yes.
Yes. A lot of fiddle on the bill. Yeah. I'm very excited to get to go out with him and Lainey Wilson. And I think that'll carry us through October. And then I'm getting hitched.
Oh, wow. So you got a really busy year. Yeah.
It's a busy year.
just do it all at once.
Yes. Let's knock it all out. And then I'm just going to sleep next year.
I remember we did a similar thing. My wife and I, we bought a house, got married, and had our first child within about, you know, an 8-month period. We just did it all at once, piled it all in there.
Yeah. Holy cow. That is insanity.
Yeah, it was a nutty couple of years, but we got through it. So good luck. I'm sure you will too. Awesome. Well, thanks for doing this today. It was so fun. It's great to meet you. I love your music and I love your new record, and it's just fantastic.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate you talking to me. This was so fun.
Absolutely.
And maybe we'll see you at the Grammys.
For sure. All right, that was Haley Witters on Walking the Floor. Go stream her new album, Raise, out everywhere, and it's great. You're going to love it. That's it for this week. I'm going to go walk the hard streets of Bogota, Colombia, and go be a good little tourist. I'll see you in a couple weeks, people. Adios, amigos!